Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia Exceed plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you are very welcome to Liveline. I'm sitting in for Joe today. And first, I want to talk to you about Dr. Martin Lawler. Dr. Lawler was a top psychiatric consultant, originally from Tralee in County Kerry, but he had moved to the UK and was based there with his family. But he'd come back home just before Christmas in 2018 to spend some time with his family here in Ireland, and was heading back to have Christmas with his own family in the UK when he was tragically killed in a hit-and-run accident while he was walking near his hotel near Cork Airport. I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Susan Lawler, Martin's sister. Susan, you're very welcome to Liveline.
Thanks a million. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, Susan, I know you're so anxious that, you know, your brother, who is so special to you and so special to so many people, is not remembered just as a statistic, but as somebody who contributed so much to so many people.
Yeah, that's correct. I think it's important, really, to tell our story. And I suppose it is imperative just to highlight, really, that this is our narrative. And the story that probably will unfold today is to do with the unfortunate, untimely death of my brother, Dr. Martin Lawler. And I want to speak my truth and my family's truth, for, in particular, for those that have no voice, and really, you know, tell my story for those who can't tell theirs. And it's, you know, an extremely difficult situation for everybody involved, because, you know, there are no winners here. We're all but losers, and my family and I are nothing now but survivors. And I just want to point out that, you know, the story that my family and I have, it is our narrative. And unfortunately, there are accidents and tragedies that take place on a daily basis that are accidents. And it is different to what happened to us.
And of course, before we say anything else, I should say our sympathies and our condolences and that of all the team here, because it's clear that, you know, this happened, as you say, just before 2018. But it is only in the last few weeks that you really came to understand the detail of what happened to your brother that night in Cork.
Yes, that's correct. I suppose really going back to the day in question, on the 15th of December 2018, our world changed forever. I was downtown that morning, and I received a phone call from my mother, and she was really, the only term you could do was wailing down the phone and exceptionally upset, and she just kept crying and screaming, saying that my baby, my Martin, my little boy is dead. They left him there to die. And she just kept repeating, my baby, my baby's dead, my baby's dead. And the phone line went dead. And my instincts in that moment in time was to bring my brother John, Dr. John Lawler, because I suppose in all intents and purposes, I was only speaking to Mark myself, you know, a few hours before that, you know, the day before.
So you had no idea what had happened at this stage?
Nothing, none. I had no idea, no comprehension whatsoever. And nice. I was thinking he was on a flight back to Manchester because he was to collect his daughter, Jennifer, who studied medicine in Liverpool University. And he was on the flight back to the UK to collect his daughter to return home for Christmas to Helen and the three children.
And so, the other, his other children, just to say that now, what ages were they?
So when he died, they were 12, 14 and 18. So Rebecca was 12, Samuel was 14, and Ginzy or Jennifer was 18. So they're young kids, very young kids.
Yeah. And as you say, you thought, you understood that he was on his way to pick up his oldest daughter
and head on home then for a family Christmas.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we had only been celebrating Christmas ourselves the day before with him, which was very typical of our family. We've always celebrated actually three Christmases. Christmas is a big time for my family and I. That particular Christmas was very special because, like for everybody, there's Santi. And it is also Jinsey's birthday, 4 days after Christmas, Becky's birthday, 4 days before Christmas, and it should have been Martin's 50th birthday. And that's why I was downtown purchasing his cards, because we had a family celebration for all of our family to come together for dinner and a night of celebration to, I suppose, honour him as our brother and for, you know, what he represented to us as being such a kind, caring, loving brother and father and son to us, and also to mark him being a phenomenal mental health expert, you know. And we were super excited for Christmas. Obviously, the children were super excited, you know, for Santi. And I instantly, you know, rang my brother John instinctively. And I just said, John, did something happen? Was there a bereavement? And Mommy's on the phone. And she's after saying that there is a baby that's dead, a baby Martin. I was like, I'm not aware. Like, is there a baby that has passed on and what happened? And there was just a silence on the phone. And he said, I'm sorry to tell you, Suze, but our brother is dead. He said, your Martin is dead. He was killed in a hit and run near Cork Airport this morning. I'm sorry. And instinctively, I just kept repeating the same thing, going, it can't be true. Like, this can't be true. Because I kept saying to her, John, how can this be true? I'm only off the phone from him. You know, like, obviously, if you are for that, this can't be true. This can't be true. And he said, I am so sorry, Suze. But he is. He said, your Martin is dead. He was killed this morning and left at the side of the road. And it just... It was like being hit by a bus. It was like having an outer body experience. And I just kept repeating the same thing and saying, it can't be true, it can't be true, it has to be a mistake. And I kept saying, did you check with the Gardaí? Is it definitely him? Is the case of mistaken identity? But when he actually noted that, obviously his ID showed who he was. But when John actually then noted the Christmas presents I had purchased for Martin and Helen and the children, I knew then, because John wouldn't have known, you know, what I had gotten the children. And it just literally, it was just incredibly difficult. It was just like our whole world imploded in that moment in time.
I can't, I can only imagine. Susan, that is, and you were just standing on the street on the phone.
Yeah, I was just standing that morning. It was about, I actually remember the exact time, it was 9:52 in the morning, and I was at the side, literally at this street, at the main street, literally purchasing his birthday cards. And I made my way home. Just, it was like having an out-of-body experience, and I came up the path hearing the wails and screams of my parents. And it was quite difficult, because you realise your life and our life were changed forever. And it destroyed us. You know, it destroyed us, because we are and we will remain so an exceptionally close family. And I suppose for my parents, it was exceptionally difficult to comprehend, because they have sacrificed their lives for my brothers and I. I have three brothers and myself, and my parents are totally, utterly salt of the earth. We're from a working class background, but we've worked exceptionally hard. And
were you all doctors? Or are you all gone into the medical?
In 2008, I became the third doctor. So we had a psychiatric consultant, a vet, and myself then, a mental health doctor. So we all went into, I suppose, a healthcare or caring/caring background, really, you know.
And I suppose because of your bond then, because of the psychiatry, your mutual interest in that area, you would have brought you even closer to Martin.
Yeah, we were exceptionally close, because we were together either physically or mentally or either which way every day, because we had worked together over 13 years ago. I had worked with him and the team in CRSI. We had set up the Centre of Recovery and Social Inclusion, which was a charity, once again in the area of mental health. And then we proceeded to the team, and I and Martin and all of us together then opened up State of Mind about 7, going on now 8 years ago. And both of us were exceptionally passionate about the area, and Martin in particular had this innate kindness, and he was such a caring man. He was just an absolute genius. He was just an exemplary in his professionalism, and he deeply cared about his patients, and he treated everybody, no matter who they were, with the utmost respect, and just was considerably passionate about helping those that couldn't help themselves.
And I know, because this was particularly what struck to the heart of your trauma then, to hear what happened to him that night, and that somebody who had done so much to help other people had been left in the way he was.
Yeah, it was just... It was just shocking. It was just incredibly difficult to comprehend how a man of such kindness and such compassion was ultimately abandoned at the side of the road.
Susan, but just at that stage, when you were coming to terms with what had happened, what were the guards able to tell you at that stage?
At that moment in time, my parents and I really didn't know very much. There was a liaison guard that was in touch with Helen and my brother John. It really wasn't until 2 weeks ago, when we had the court case, that my parents and I actually discovered the full truth and the actual factual evidence of what happened. And on that particular day, my brother John and I were at the court, and Helen came through via video link, and it was exceptionally upsetting and difficult to hear. And I suppose what happened really that night was Mart was walking on the right-hand side of the roadway, which would have been facing the oncoming traffic heading for the city.
Which was the way he was supposed to be walking.
Yes, yeah, the correct way, yeah, the correct side of the road. And he was struck with such force that he was thrown into the middle of the opposite left-hand outbound lane. And the man in question never stopped the car. He kept driving, and he proceeded to drive with the windscreen, which was smashed. His wing mirror was falling off, and the front light was broken. And he then proceeded to collect another fare at the Kingsley Hotel.
Yeah, just to explain to people, this man who was driving the car that hit your brother was a taxi driver. He was, and we should say, because he has now been sentenced, Dennis McSweeney. He's a 75-year-old man from Pool of Duff Road, Ballyfahan in Cork. And he was jailed for 4 years for driving away from the scene of that accident, that collision, in December 2018, and for failing to stop, failing to keep the vehicle at the scene, failing to report the incident to Gardaí, failing to give appropriate information to Gardaí. But as you say, he was a taxi driver who was out working on the night, and you discovered in court that after hitting your brother, he drove on and took another fare, and took that fare to their destination.
Yeah, and as well, I mean, it's important to emphasise as well that even Judge Sean O'Donovan stipulated in court that this man was, quote-unquote, fully aware that he had hit my brother. And he actually rejected the court's claims that this man, quote-unquote, panicked. And he even asked the court himself, the judge asked the court and said, why did the driver not stop? He said, I don't believe it was panic. I reject panic. I'm left with nothing but, quote-unquote, callousness. And the man's barrister himself, Dolan O'Sullivan, even emphasised to the court that this man continued working even though the car was not drivable or not safe to be driven. So this man hit my brother, knew he hit my brother.
And obviously knew he had hit him with considerable force if that amount of damage had been done to the car.
Well, I mean, you can imagine yourself. I mean, I know anybody who drives a car, even if you're driving on a beach at 2, 3, 4 kilometres or miles per hour, and even if there's pebbles on, you know, on the ground, you feel that. So you can imagine that he hit my brother with such force that he literally landed, you know, at the middle of the opposite left-hand outbound lane. And the windscreen was smashed. So the windscreen was damaged. The windscreen is in front of the car. So as the judge said himself, he was fully aware that he hit him. But to go on then to proceed to collect another fare, and it was actually when he collected the other fare at the Kingsley Hotel, and he brought the person to the airport, and he was stopped in at the turn-off at Ballycorheen by the guards, because whilst he was doing that, my brother was found, and they had set up a checkpoint, and he was stopped because the car was damaged, and he was asked what happened, and he proceeded to tell the guards at that point in time that he, quote-unquote, hit an animal.
That's that was his initial statement. He did subsequently acknowledge, did he not, that he was aware that he had hit a pedestrian?
Subsequently, he did. Yeah, further on, he did admit that he had hit a pedestrian. Then, but actually, it was quite interesting hearing the facts of the case, because Detective Garda Breed Norris, in her evidence, actually also was saying that, you know, the weather that night, it was foggy and rainy and poor visibility. But the judge discounted it and said it was not such as to stop the taxi driver from working that night. And he even stipulated once against the court, I cannot understand how he continued on, picked up another fare and came back.
Yeah, it's I really, really do feel for you and your family, Susan, that idea of, so, you know, somebody you love, you care for so much, to have been left injured, and you don't know what way, at the side of the road.
Yeah, I mean, we were left subsequently knowing that my brother, my parents' son, was left abandoned at the side of the road. And, you know, he has left behind a young wife, Dr. Helen Murphy Lawler, 3 young kids. You know, and Helen quite eloquently portrayed the impact that it had on her and the children, and how incredibly difficult it was on their family. And, you know, she spoke of how my brother John had rang her to inform her that Mart had been killed. And she was telling the court that how immensely difficult and cruel it was, that not only the circumstances around his death and how difficult they are to come to terms with, but their inability to say goodbye, which was very hard and cruel for them and for us. But she highlighted quite a vivid picture, which is it's just soul-destroying. And she was telling the court how she'd received the news when, in fact, it should have been Martin coming through the door. She received news from her brother, from my brother John, saying that he was killed and left at the side of the road in a hit and run. And she then had to tell the children what had happened. And then they had to make the lonely journey home from Manchester to Cork onto Mill Street, soon to be reunited with Mart, home for the last time in a coffin.
It's just so devastating, so distressing, the circumstances, everything around it.
It is just beyond difficult to put it into words, really. Like, how does anybody quantify the loss of a brother, a son, a father, a husband, a cousin, a best friend, a work colleague, a mental health doctor? You know, there's no words, there's no language that you can use to really explain how it just shatters your very being and existence. You know, it's just so difficult to come to terms with such a loss. You know, Martin himself was, he just was renowned and exceptionally respected psychiatric consultant. He worked for the HSC and Nua Healthcare and for State of Mind Ireland, but he was just such a humble human being. He was just thought of the earth, and anybody, no matter who they were that needed help, he was there. He literally, every breath he took was for his family and for his work. And when he was killed, he was completing another degree himself. He was completing a degree, a master's degree in psychotherapy. And actually, that's why I returned to myself and actually acquired my fifth degree in his honour. Just to highlight how phenomenal he was and just to say, you know what, this is for us both. And as a result, I actually attained a first-class honours across my final year projects in the dissertation and in the degree itself. And I just wanted just to say to Mark, I suppose, you know, this is for you. This is for us.
I know, and I'm looking...
Just, you know, do it for everybody, like, you know.
I'm looking at a photograph of Martin here in front of me, a lovely photograph, big open smile. Going back to the court case, and I know that is what has made this so raw and has brought up so much more for you and for your family, Susan. Hearing those details about what happened that night and the circumstances and what happened immediately after your brother was struck. You were in court when that information came out.
I was in court with my brother John, and it actually took me a few minutes to comprehend what was being said. And if I'm being perfectly honest, my initial reaction was I actually thought I was going to be sick, because I was so shocked that any human being would have such little regard and respect for human life in general. It's just, I can't comprehend it. It's unfathomable how anybody would leave any person or any human entity at the side of the road. It doesn't bear recognition for me, because we are a family who helps people. I am a person, as my brother Martin was, that will always be there for any person that needs help. And it is beyond difficult to put into words how any human being could be left at the side of the road, never mind a man who was so compassionate and so caring and so innately kind. It just bears no words. I just can't comprehend how another person could leave a human being at the side of the road.
How is your mother now, Susan?
Devastated. You know, both my parents and, you know, my brothers and I and Helen, the children. I mean, it just shatters. It just shatters us. Like, I mean, it shattered us.
It just so struck me when you said that line, that your mother's opening words to you about this were that my baby is dead. And even though, as you say, he was about to turn 50, he was your mother's baby still.
Yeah, I mean, we, like, every person has to understand that, you know, through the grieving process, and this particular process is not a natural grieving process per se. It's atypical grief because of the circumstances that surround the death of my brother. It's extremely difficult to comprehend and to put into words the nature in which he died. And, you know, there's no kind of ending to this per se. You know, for us now, the healing process begins, and the healing process takes a lifetime.
I was going to ask you, Susan, because of your training, does that help you process what you're going through and what your family are going through now?
Yes, it does. And I mean, obviously it helps me as a person, because I am a human being behind the title. And also I can help my parents. But at the end of the day, everybody grieves differently, and grief has no timeline. There is no rule book, and it does pertain to the individual in question. You know, everybody needs to do what is right for them in that particular moment in time. I mean, Martin wasn't my son. He was my big brother. He was my work colleague. He was my confidant. He was my best friend. But that is totally different to my mother and father, who were his parents. And it's totally different to Helen, who is his wife, and to the three children who lost their father. I mean, you're talking about a 12, 14 and 18-year-old. You're talking about children who had to receive news that their father had been killed and was left abandoned at the side of the road. And that is something that takes a lot of time to come to terms with. And for me, on a professional capacity, grief is something you don't get over. It is something that moves with you every day. But for me as a professional, I try to channel it in a positive capacity as best as I can. And it also, enables you to be exceptionally emphatic and have a huge understanding and compassion for people who are going through life's difficulties and, in particular, tragic circumstances like my own.
Well, Susan, all I can do is, and all of us here, wish you the very, very best. And, I know you said you wanted Martin to be remembered for the very special person he was. And I think you have done him a great service today.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I really do wish you and your family the very best in coming to terms with what has. And it's just, just a split second and it has changed all your lives. It's so devastating.
Yeah, and I suppose it's just imperative just to kind of finish off on that point, because it was a split second decision. However, it was a choice that this man made. And I believe life is about choices. And he chose to not stop the car. He chose to keep driving. He chose to collect another fare. He chose to say that he hit an animal. And for me, it's imperative that people, if they are in this situation moving forward, whatever person or people are there, and if there are, accidents that will take place, to stop and remain at the scene. Do not drive on. Do not keep going. Stop, remain at the scene and get the person help. Like, give hope. Give hope to that person. Give hope to that person's family. Give hope to yourself and stand up and be accountable and say, an accident took place. And I'm sorry, and obviously everybody, will be upset. Obviously everybody will go through their journey of coming to terms, what happened, what will happen or what could happen. But it is just imperative to stay at the scene and to get help.
Was Dennis McSweeney in court when you were in court hearing this evidence?
Yes, he was.
And how did it feel to be in the same room as somebody who did that?
I think for me, it's always imperative to have respect for everyone. And, as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, there's no winners here. There's no winners. We've all lost here. And on that particular day, to be perfectly honest, was still reeling from hearing the facts and evidence of the case. And I was just focused on Helen and listening intently to her words and feeling quite moved and upset, and also listening to the judge and what he had to say and the barristers and Detective Garda. And, it was just a lot to comprehend and to process and to take in. And for me, I just wanted to really focus on giving the victim impact statement and to ensure that I was able to speak my truth for those in particular that can't and that don't have a voice. And, I just wanted to make sure that the story was told, because Martin was no longer here. And I know that if the shoe was on the other foot, he would have done the same. And I wanted Martin to be remembered for the phenomenal human being that he was, and not just this, number on a board that he was some type of statistic. I wanted to publicly highlight that he was just a phenomenal human being.
Well, you have certainly done that. Dr. Susan Lawler, many, many thanks for talking to us about Martin and about that awful tragedy that you're going through as a family. And as I say, we wish you all the best.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Olivia Staunton, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, Olivia, listening to Susan there brought back some memories for you.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. 25 years ago, at Christmas, last Christmas, my brother was killed on in a hit and run and was left there to for another car to drive over him. So, yeah, and it's like, you know, it's never easy. You know, you never forget.
And did you discover who was responsible, Olivia?
No, we never found out who was responsible. No, it was just after the inquest, it was put down as a hit and run and nobody came forward or no, there was nothing else. You know, if we had what we would the people that we have now, you know, to analyse it, it would have been a lot different, I'm sure, 25 years ago.
And I know, I suppose, any death, sudden death of a young person like that is going to be so shocking and so tragic. But there's just that extra layer of devastation when it's a hit and run.
Absolutely. You know, there's no words to describe the devastation into a family and friends of the victim. At the end of the day, you know, my brother went out, you know, for a few hours and never came home, you know, and that's the saddest part of it.
And what age was he, Olivia? Sorry to cut across. What age
That's
was
okay.
he?
He was 17.
Oh, so young.
Yeah, so young. And he was, we do know that something struck him at the side of the head. We do know that he had a hole in the side of his head, you know. So we know that from that. And then he was left there then. And unfortunately, the poor man that drove over him then, there was nothing he could do.
Yeah, I was just thinking, that must have been very traumatic for that driver.
Oh, absolutely. There's no words. I mean, that man was coming home from work and there was a dip in the road and Michael was there and there was nothing that man could do, you know. But he did stop and he ran to a neighbour's house, which turned out to be Michael's godfather, you know, which was a coincidence. But, you know, he knew the minute he saw him, he said, I know that chap, you know. And yeah. Then you have, like that lady was saying, you know, the devastated parents hanging out of a guard to come into the door, you know, and hysterical. And but, you know, your life is never the same, but you do learn to just get up every day and get on with it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you're, what, 22 years or 3 years down, further down the road from where Susan and her family are now. So what would you say to her in that line?
Oh, look, there's so much, you know, there's so much you could say, but, you know, they have to, you know, they have to get on with the grieving process. And, but, yeah, look, you do remember the good times and the laughs, and because, you know, my brother Michael was a funny chap, you know, there was never a dull moment. But, you know, you have to remember the good times. And unfortunately, you have no choice but to get up and get on with every day. It does get easier, but you never forget.
No, and of course, you don't want to forget either.
No, absolutely not. No, yeah, and you have to, you know, unfortunately, Mam passed away. Mam and Dad have both passed away since, and they never got any closure on it. But still, you know, they remember the good times that we all had and the funny times around the table and the arguing and the, yeah. But it's never easy. You know, I was just filling the dishwasher now when I turned on the radio and you still shed a tear 25 years later and you still think of, if only, you know.
What could have been?
What could have been? Yeah, his whole life ahead of him. He just had everything, you know.
He would have. Was he still in school at that stage?
He had just finished his leaving. Yeah, he had just finished his leaving. So he was going to really enjoy life. There was no doubt about that.
Oh, so sad. And tell me, at the time, was there an investigation? Was there an attempt to identify what had happened? Or
no, at the inquest, there was a couple of, say, lorry drivers and people who you would have used the road, they were asked to attend. But there was never, you know, they couldn't just pinpoint, nobody came forward or nobody, there was no evidence to say that it was this particular vehicle or it was, you know. But somebody has a conscience, there's somebody out there has a conscience. You know, let it be 25 years later, you know, and, you know, even if that one person told somebody else or somebody else has a conscience, you know, and I'm so delighted that they got somebody for that. It doesn't make it any easier, you know. I mean,
but I suppose it does give you some closure. I mean, as a family, did you imagine that maybe at some stage down the line you would find out what really happened?
Yeah, my poor mum used to always say, if they just sent an anonymous note to say, look, I'm sorry, I did it, you know, no name or anything, just that if she just had it known that somebody had the decency to just let us know that they were terribly sorry and that was, you know, they did it. But look, it never came, and it's definitely not going to come now. But, you know, when I heard that lady say about being left like an animal on the side of the road, you know, that's really what it's like, you know. You hit a dog and you'd be devastated.
Well, you wouldn't drive on if you hit a dog. That's the
no,
or a fox or anything. I mean, I think it's quite a shocking story to hear that somebody would strike somebody to the degree to cause that much damage, in this case to a car,
yeah,
and drive on. Is it's very hard to come to terms with that.
It is very hard to come to terms with it and to continue on to do, you know, your job. And, you know, look, there's no words for that, really. You just, and I'm so glad they have, you know, that they have somebody for it, you know.
And as you say, Olivia, you don't know if the person who hit and killed your brother and drove on, you don't know if they're still out there. They might be out there listening to this today, and that they have carried this for 25 years.
Yeah, there is somebody, I'm sure, yeah, somebody knows that. You know, they know that they passed the area that morning or something. You know, it was a main road. You know, it's the main road from Dublin to Buncrody. You know, it's everybody knows it. Mm-hmm. You know, but look, they have a conscience. We have to carry the grief, and as I said, 25 years later, and we're still carrying it. You know, and we'll never get over it.
Yeah.
You know.
Olivia, 25 years later, our condolences.
Thank you very much.
On the loss of Michael. And thank you for calling in with that. And we'll take another break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And it's Katie Hannan sitting in for Joe today. And I want to go now from those very tragic stories of death and of incredible callous behaviour from people in those two stories, to the absolute opposite, a story of life and of a good Samaritan. And I want to go to Frieda Farrell. Frieda, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Frieda, your story has brightened up my day, can I tell you? And we needed your story today.
Yes, it's some good news.
It's great news, and an amazing, amazing work on your behalf. Let's tell people, you own the Westhouse Cafe and B&B in Longford.
Yes, that's correct. We're on the N5 here on the West Road, just outside of Longford Town.
And you'd be operating as a B&B, but with COVID, you've had some longer staying for longer.
Yes, we have some longer term people. Of course, people aren't moving around as much and they're isolating and everybody's following the COVID guidelines. And so they're staying put at the moment.
And you had a young couple who had a baby born to them just before Christmas.
Just after Christmas, and the baby was just a month old there on the 1st of February or around that. And it was on the 1st of February this occurred.
OK, so talk me through it. You're in your B&B and you hear what?
Yes, what is a normal day, and normally everybody goes about their business and comes and goes. And at the moment, of course, with the COVID, there's nobody mixing. And so everybody comes and goes and does their own thing, their own business. So on that day, which was unusual, we heard screaming from the downstairs hallway. And we weren't quite sure what was happening. It was unusual for us because it's normally quiet here. And so I went down to check it out, and I went into the hallway to find the parents of the baby. The mum was, they were both deeply distressed, and the mum was screaming, "She's gone, she's gone." And the dad was, "She's gone, she's gone." And I said, "Who? What? You know, what?" It took me a few minutes to realise what was actually happening. And then I realised, well, the dad was running up and down the hall and mum was screaming and she was on the phone as well. And it took me a few moments to realise the dad had the baby under one of his arms, and then he showed me the baby, and they were both deeply distressed, naturally enough. So I took the baby from them.
So this is a tiny baby now, 4 weeks old.
Yes, just tiny little baby. It was just over 6 pounds born, so very, a tiny little baby. So I took the baby from them, and I took her down to the parents' bedroom, and I threw back the duvet on their bed, and I put her on the middle of the centre of the mattress so that, well, she wouldn't fall off anywhere. She couldn't fall off, she couldn't go anywhere. But there was absolutely no response whatsoever from her. Her little chest was gone flat, her little tummy was gone flat. There was absolutely no response whatsoever. There was no breathing, no nothing. And she had gone kind of a blue-grey colour. So there was absolutely no response whatsoever from her. And I knew there was no air in her lungs because I could see that her little chest was gone completely flat. So
now you sound like you're very competent in this very, what would be a hugely panicky scenario for most people. Are you medically trained, Frieda?
I think the adrenaline just kicks in. You just go into flight or fight mode and the adrenaline just kicks in and you have to do something when you're just faced with that. You just have to act. There was no time to think about it. But I could see, like, I worked as a care worker back in the 1990s for 7 years here locally in St. Joseph's and Longford Care Centre, which was excellent there. Mm-hmm. But I worked as a care worker, and we would have, at that time, of course, you would have done CPR and first aid and all your health and safety and various things. But, I wouldn't have updated it over, I suppose you never forget, but at the same time, luckily enough, early January last year in 2020, a friend of mine is involved with the Longford and Newtown Forest first responders. And luckily enough, she mentioned to me there was a course coming up on CPR and she was going to it and she would have been interested in going. Luckily enough, I went to it because I wouldn't have actually done CPR on an infant before. I would have done it on, I would have been shown how to resuscitate an adult, but I actually wouldn't have been shown on an actual infant. So luckily enough, the last thing which we done on that course was how to resuscitate an infant. And I said, thank God.
Oh my God, thank God. Like just 12 months ago, you were told how to save this baby's life, basically. You could never have imagined you would have found yourself in this position.
No, nobody ever expects that you're put in that position.
Okay, so we're back in the bedroom then. You're looking at this little four-week-old baby and it's not breathing. Is it a little boy or a little girl?
Absolutely no response whatsoever. So,
is it a boy or a girl, Frieda?
I said, you know, I could see like that her little chest was so flat. And I said, there's absolutely no oxygen whatsoever. There's no air getting in there. There's nothing happened there at all. So the first thing I done were I done mouth to mouth, just gave three little, very light breaths until I seen her chest just rise slightly. Well, I said, at least she's getting a little bit of air, a little bit of oxygen. And then I started doing CPR, which is just your two first fingers into the centre of the chest, just below the chest bone. And I just continuously counted 1, 2, 3, 4. You just continuously count, keep going until you get a response. And even if you don't get a response, keep going until emergency services come. That's the thing. But now it did take a while. She didn't respond immediately. I was working on her. Well, I worked on her for 15 minutes. Now, it took a few minutes before I could even see her colour starting to change. And with a newborn baby, of course, I could see, first, she was a blue-grey colour, and the first thing I could see was that her colour changed her head. She went red, and I could see the blood starting to come back down to her little veins and go up through her veins in her neck. And she went red first, and I could see the blood come back, start to flow, and then she went a completely pale colour. I knew she was very, very weak. Mm-hmm. And like I was still working on her for another few minutes before, and she did open her eyes and she gave a very little weak cry, but I knew she was extremely weak. But she did come to for me. And then the dad had
the relief,
called,
Frieda, the relief must have been unbelievable.
Well, you know, it was afterwards, 2 or 3 days afterwards. I couldn't even think about it for the first 24 or 48 hours. I couldn't even think about what happened. I was praying for her that she was going to keep going and come through. I said, you know, the first like 2 or 3 days is critical, like for anybody if anything serious happens. So I was just praying that she'd keep going and keep improving. And she did, thankfully. And it was really only 4 or 5 days later I started to think about what had happened.
Yeah. And as you say, they had called an ambulance. Her parents had called an ambulance.
Somebody had called an ambulance, and I knew they had called an ambulance because they put them on speakerphone. Now, I couldn't actually hear them because the parents were very distressed, and I couldn't actually even hear the emergency services, what they were saying to me, but I just kept going with what I was doing, and I kept going until the ambulance services arrived. Now, the baby had opened her little eyes and she had a meek little cry before the ambulance services came. So I just stayed talking to her and rather her little Tommy, and just for until the ambulance people came in. They came in, then they worked on her for a half an hour here before they took her away to stabilise her, before they took her to the hospital, and they removed her then to the general hospital, and they stabilised her, made sure she was completely stabilised, and then she was moved on. She was moved on to Dublin to intensive care, so that she was very, very seriously ill. But the mum said during all of this that she did have a little heart condition, so she was removed to Dublin to intensive care. And so the first few days,
we're touch and go.
She was extremely critical, but she showed very, very slight little responses. So she did come around, and she's come to, and she's now she's still in hospital. She's doing well. She's improving. But of course, she will have to have her heart condition treated when she's I suppose grown another little bit when she's a little bit older.
Well, let me tell you, Frieda, I want you around if ever I'm in a crisis. That's for sure.
Oh, my God.
Would you normally be kind of regarded as a cool head?
Well, I probably would be fairly... I probably would be pretty cool. I probably would be fairly cool. But, you know, when you're presented with something like that, I know enough to know that, well, if somebody does collapse or go unconscious or something, the quicker you can get in there, and the quicker, even if a person can only do the compressions, nothing more than the compressions to the chest, even if they don't do the mouth-to-mouth, if they can do the compressions to the chest, they can keep the circulation moving and they can keep the oxygen going to the brain. Even if the person doesn't come around for you until the emergency services come, you can still do a lot for the person by just doing that.
Yeah, not for the first time, I'm thinking. This is something that we should all be taught in school, and we should all have refresher courses on regularly.
Know.
Yeah, it's just something that should be a skill. That's
And I think especially with the COVID now at the moment, you know, the medical services are so concentrated on COVID and they're so busy with the COVID. Then if anything else occurs outside of that, well, everything, like if something like this occurs, it's all about time.
Yeah. And it's so important to be there at that moment and not to panic and to know what to do.
A person from every household should really know how to do CPR. And even now in COVID times, like even if a person gets, for whatever reason, that somebody would simply know how to do CPR could be the difference between keeping them alive and not.
Indeed. Frieda, as I say, that's Frieda Farrell from Longford there. You have brightened our day in here today, and I'm sure you've brightened many other days with that story. Fair play to you is all I can say. That is very impressive.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Frieda. And I want to go to Paul Stanley now, because Paul, you have another story of a good Samaritan.
I have indeed, Kate.
You work for Bumbulance, the children's ambulance.
Yeah, the National Children's Ambulance Service. And nothing was harder than our last call, but on last Friday, I was transporting little Lucy from Crumlin down to Kenmare. And there was a few spot floods on the road between Mitchellstown and Mallow. And I drove through one of the puddles, hit a pothole, and got a blowout. Mm. And that sounds okay to describe, but it was lashing rain, it was cold. I knew straight away that I had a flat, so I put my hazards on. Found a little spot to pull in, but the guy directly behind me knew that something was up, and he pulled in directly behind me. Mm-hmm. And he gets out and he offers his help straight away, and I tell him, yeah, thanks very much, but I would have struggled now doing it myself. It would have taken a lot longer, but with this guy's help, we were on our way again in 40 minutes.
Were you doing this now in the lashing rain, so this guy got out of his car to help you?
He got out of the van, exactly, and while I was trying to retrieve the spare tyre from underneath, I turned and he was after getting his own jack, a blanket, and he's down kneeling on the ground, jacking up the ambulance.
God, wouldn't it restore your faith in human nature?
In the back? Yeah. Absolutely heartwarming. But he didn't know I had anybody in the back of the ambulance. And he got talking and I says, I have a little girl on the stretcher. He says, you have not? I says, have, yeah. And my mammy's sitting beside her. So that made him all the more keen to get us going, getting on the road.
Wow.
But without his help, I definitely would have been stuck. It'd have been another hour and a half getting it together to get going. But all I got from the chap was, his name was Dan, he was from Cork, and just as I was leaving, I took a photograph of his van, because I had a decal on it. And I was going to send this to the office to send off a thank you. But of course, when I got moving and checked, when I got Lucy home and checked the phone, I had no photograph. So all I know is Dan in the white van helped me out, and he's a Cork man.
Okay, Dan from Cork in the white van. Yeah. White van man, Dan.
Yeah, white van man, Dan.
If you're out there, give us a shout. We'd love to talk to you. That is really, as I say, heartwarming to think that in the pouring rain, not even knowing that there was anyone. And I mean, obviously,
exactly,
I suppose many of us would stop if we thought there was a little girl in the back of that ambulance.
Yeah,
but he didn't know that. He was just helping out a fellow motorist.
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes, because of the vehicle I was in, it doesn't look like an ambulance. It's a small van. It's a Mercedes Vito. So it doesn't really have the look of an ambulance. I was actually stopped one day and asked, how many bouncy castles did I deliver today? That's how serious it is. But it just has a decal of a D on the back of it and a bumblance and a little text message. If you want to donate, you can text fuel to 5300, that kind of thing on it. But he had no idea. He just thought, I just goes in trouble and I stopped straight away. I hadn't even said thanks for helping. He was out of the van. So, I mean, fair play to him. Not everyone would do it.
No.
So,
but Dan did. And so, as I say, Dan, give us a call if you're out there. We'd love to pass on those thanks. And
Bumblance would love to thank him.
Okay. Listen, Paul, and thanks to yourself for calling us with that story. We appreciate
very
that.
Much, Kate.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And we opened the programme today talking to Susan Lawler, whose brother Martin was killed in a hit-and-run accident in December 2018. And our conversation has obviously triggered a lot of memories for a lot of people because, you know, this happens and it leaves terrible tragedy and grief in its wake. I want to go now to Gloria Brereton. Gloria, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you? Yeah, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for calling in, Gloria. Gloria, your son, Gary, died in a hit and
Gary.
Run.
Yeah, he was. He was walking home with a friend from a nightclub, the Ambassador, in Naas, along the Naas Road, as it was. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning. The weather was very bad, and I was away. I was in Holland at the time. Gary had just turned 20 at Christmas, and this was 3 weeks later. And I got a call in Holland to say that he'd had an accident and that he was dead. And then all the horriblessness came through that he'd been killed a hit and run. Somehow he'd got separated from the friend he was supposed to have been walking home with. And he was hit, so the police tell me, by two cars. It was two cars that hit him, and the two cars left the scene and just left him there like an animal in the road. And he was just lying there until somebody came across him. And it was a bread van on the opposite side of the road was driving up towards Naas, and he saw a car swerve. And so he stopped. He thought there was something wrong. So he went over and he met... there was a red taxi stopped at the scene, and a red taxi got out, and he was standing over Gary's body, and the bread van says, "Oh God, I'll go and get help," because there was no mobile phones in those days, you know. So he just drove, and then when the ambulance finally came, that person had left the scene as well. So Gary was still there on his own in the middle of the road.
So, sorry, do we think that the red taxi driver, the man who was driving the red taxi, may have been involved, may have been one of the cars that hit Gary?
Yeah, we think so. The police were looking for a red taxi for a long, long time, and they couldn't find one. I can't understand. But I think he was already hit by another car.
Before that?
Before that. I would love the police to tell me exactly what happened, but it's just so... Just nobody came forward. I'm left here. This was in 1993, when I was 40. And here I am, now just over 70, and I still don't know who killed him.
And your line is going a little for us there, but hopefully it'll hold up, Gloria. You're saying this happened in 1993. And there was... obviously an attempt at an investigation. The Gardaí did investigate what had happened, but as you say, they never found anyone to interview in relation to it.
No, nobody. And then they opened up the case a few years ago. Well, no, a few years later. And still, again, they couldn't find anybody that did it. And, I'm left in limbo. Just would love to know who killed him.
And, I mean, as you say, it's over 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Or it's coming up on 30 years now.
It still hurts.
Gary was 20 years old when this happened?
Yeah, just 20 years old.
And what was he doing? Tell me about Gary.
He was a devil. He was in his first job. He was working for a jeweller and he was great at football. And he was a great golfer. He loved his sports, you know. And he was just a lovely lad. And his friends all loved him. And even now, every year on the anniversary, we all meet up. And, you know, they've never deserted him either, and they've never deserted me. They're great.
Yeah.
There's not an awful lot more I can say.
No, but
I just remain brokenhearted.
I was going to say, yeah, and the fact, it's the not knowing. What actually happened? That just adds again, as Olivia and Susan was saying, it's just a whole other layer to the devastation around the loss that would have been, you know, horrific anyway.
Yeah, it is. It's just not knowing, and I'll never get closure on this, and I just don't know how they're living with it. There's two people out there who know what went on, and they're living with it, and if you know. As I heard one of the ladies say, if they could just send an anonymous note, you know, to say sorry or something like that, but I don't think it'll happen now at this stage.
But yeah, as you say, if you had just some acknowledgement.
Yeah.
That it had happened and that there was remorse or there was some reason for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you hold out hope over the years, Gloria, that might come your way?
I did. It was like picking at a scab all the time. I was picking at it and going to the police and begging them to, you know, what happened. And just lately, after getting all the case notes from the solicitor, he doesn't know how they survived, but they've given them to me. And there's an awful lot of stuff in there that doesn't make sense, you know, and I would love to take the whole case file back to the police, but is it any good for me? Would it do me any good now to start again? You know, I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. And I have all these notes in front of me, you know, of his case.
And have you got anyone with you, Gloria, you know, to help you, you know, to advise you on what to do now that you've, you know, you've obviously... Your solicitor has obviously been able to unearth this new material.
He was retiring. The solicitor was retiring. We're in Dublin, and he just found the file, and I rang him. I don't know. Out of the blue, somebody said to me, "Would you not try a solicitor again?" And I rang, and he looked in his files, and he couldn't believe that he still had the case. And so he's put it all into an envelope and he sent it to me and I have it here in my house. But I don't have anybody to help me. No, I don't. I don't know what to do with it. It's heartbreaking to read and a lot of it just doesn't make sense. And
yeah, I imagine, you know, at this remove, maybe many of the people who made the guards who might have worked on that case would no longer be serving.
No. No.
I suppose you would need to have some familiarity about how these files are put together to understand what's in there.
Yeah, because there's all the witness statements and all stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff that I didn't even know happened at the time and stuff that the police didn't tell me, but it's all there in the file.
Yeah, and maybe the Gardaí at the time were sparing you some of the detail.
that's possibly, yeah, because I do know a lot of the detail and it's not very nice, and I wouldn't say it on air, you know, not very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gloria, I don't know what to say to you except to say, again, you know, all these years later, we are so sorry for your loss, and to put that word out there again to make people understand that you can't, you know, if something like that, if you find yourself in this situation, you have to stay and try and help. It's not, it's the extra pain and suffering that comes from people leaving the scene in these scenarios is devastating.
It's terrible. I mean, I look at his lovely face every single day and I just say to him, Gary, what happened? You know, why you? What happened? I say that every single morning when I wake up.
Gloria, our condolences, Gloria. Gloria, thank you for that. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And I want to go now to Emer. Emer, good afternoon to you.
Hi, hi, Casey. How are you?
I'm good, Emer. And how are you?
Well, I'm doing well. I had surgery on Monday and I'm now recuperating in my sister's.
Yeah. Okay, just to explain to people, you have a spinal issue which required surgery.
Yeah. So in 2018, I had emergency surgery. From that, I now have a condition called myelopathy, which is nerve damage. For me, it's nerve damage in the lower legs with foot drop in the left foot. So last February, I had further surgery. No, in first week of March. And then on Monday, I had further surgery. My last swim would have been the last February, last Friday in February last year.
Sorry, swimming. And swimming is the physio for this condition.
Swimming is huge for me. It's huge for me because it's low impact physical work. Okay, I can't trod the streets because of my condition. If I walk, it's only for 10 minutes, and then I have to rest. So I'm not actually getting in proper physical activity. I walk with the crutch and I have a foot brace on the left foot. So for me to get in to work my muscles and build up strength in my legs has always been swimming.
And just to be aerobically fit, obviously, is your only...
Yes, but the other thing is that I need it for cardiovascular, because quite obviously I'm not able to walk fast and, you know, build up the heart or whatever. Now I have and I do look after myself, but it's not for recreational, Casey. It's for my progress of my condition. Mm-hmm. And it's not only for me, it's for people that have had hip and knee replacements, that they would need the hydrotherapy exercise. The other thing is that there's people that can't take meds, that the water is actually good for them. They say that the water is the other pain relief now. But my bone of contention really is that nobody is taking this into consideration, what, you know, for people like me. Yes, they can open up the rugby, the GAA matches. You have training. And it's also come to my attention that the aquatic centre has been open for competitive swimmers.
Your local pool did it open up during the summer when we dropped down to a lower level?
No.
So your pool hasn't been open since
no.
COVID arrived, no. Basically.
No, and I used to live in the Blanchetown area, so I used to use Cool Mind Sports and Leisure. And I'd build up a rapport with the staff. They knew me, and I would be frightened to go into another pool in case it's thought that I was a slip and risk, you know, because I used the crutch.
Yeah.
So they haven't been open, no. And now here we are, and now on my second operation, none of that physical exercise for me in the pool, and nobody has discussed going forward when the next when the gyms or the swimming pools are going to be open. But I'm not asking for the swimming pools to be open per se. I'm asking for them to consider the amount of people that actually need it as a physical improvement.
For physio,
Yeah,
there must be a lot of people. I mean, I know a lot of us give out about the, you know, another feckin' walk, as we now has come to be known, because this is what we're left with. But it's easy to forget that there's a lot of people who would give anything to be able to do another feckin' walk.
Well, do you know what, Casey? Up to 2018, I was walking my 5Ks. I was doing my swimming, my Pilates. And so this is the only thing that has actually given me both mental and physical, how would you say, therapy for me, mm-hmm. you know? But I definitely need it to improve on my leg.
And as you say, you are definitely not alone. As I say, there must be quite a few people who can't do, you know, other more robust physical exercise. And of course, we know as well that sea swimming became this huge issue.
Yeah.
For
now,
our
I'm
huge
actually
pastime.
With a COVID group. I met them during last summer because I've actually moved out towards the sea. And amazing group of ladies. And they'll actually help me in. They walk me in and to a point where, and then they take my crutch back out. But Casey, that's not swimming. I get the buzz. I'm elated when I go out, but I'm actually not able to do a physical swim in the sea.
Right.
The currents or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and as I say, I was going to say that a lot of people, you know, asking for that 5K limit to be lifted for people who... Mm-hmm. were getting the buzz and really that was their outlet, sea swimming, but they're now more than 5K away from the sea and they haven't been able to get there. But as you say, it's not the same as access to a pool and being able to actually properly swim.
Yeah.
And
walk up and down, you know, and that's part of, say, somebody with a knee replacement, to walk up and down to, and you're not having that pressure of streets and that it's the low impact exercise that is so important to people of my condition and, as I say, for people with hip and knee surgeries.
And is there any, have you spoken to any, you know, managers of pools or any people with any information on this of when they've been given an indication of when they might be able to open?
Well, I haven't because it hasn't been in... you know, the guideline of the government when it's going to be open. So they're waiting on them to give them the go-ahead. I mean, nothing has been mentioned about to my knowledge this week, about the gyms or the swimming pools. So it's like, you know, sometime maybe, I'm thinking, and I'm hoping June, but realistically, that's 18 months then on, and I really feel it's having an effect on my progress.
Yeah, and as I say, I'm sure you're not alone, Emer. But I suppose if you think about it, that's the big complaint from yesterday. There's so much has been left unsaid out of our new plan for living, because as we were being told, they don't know with the new variants. They you know, nobody's willing to put a date or a number on at what point any of the facilities that are currently closed might be opened up.
And I understand that, Casey. However, a swimming pool can be more structured than, say, a rugby match, which is close contact. And many of them have actually been, there has been a few, I should say, that have tested COVID because they are in a close contact game, as is the GAA. We had people in certain clubs that were tested because it was a close contact. You're in a pool and it can be structured. And the lanes, to the best of my knowledge, are probably nearly a metre and a half apart. And most of them have at least 5 lanes. So it can be more structured than, say, the other games that have been allowed for whatever reason.
Okay. Eimear, we're going to have to leave it there. We're right out of time. We hope you won't fall on deaf ears. We may hear more on that one. But that's it from today. Today's programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman. Maeve Mooney was the BCO and Cara O'Hare was on sound. And Joe will be back with you. But we'll go now to the break. And to Ray.